Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in...
Kia ora, everyone. The annual New Zealand International Film Festival is on in Auckland at the moment, the 50th anniversary. In fact, Karen?
50th year, wow.
Yeah. So, I was looking at the program. All our libraries every year have printed versions of the program for those who find it easier than searching for their movie pick online. So, I was really pleased. On page 94 in the program is an index of all the movies by category. They've categorized them.
This is new. This is great.
Yeah.
Does it have like tearjerkers? What is it called? I love tearjerkers.
Okay, so they have animation, animals, blindness, human
blindness,
rights.
A whole category of blindness.
How many movies?
Oh, there's only two
movies. But you will be pleased to see that women make features, so I guess women who have made movies, has the largest listing underneath at 29 movies. And you will be equally pleased to know that based on books, the category based on books is the next largest category. So there you go.
Very good. I wonder how many overlap. I wonder how many of those are women who've made movies out of books.
Oh, true. I didn't count that.
We'll do a quick mathematical calculation.
Yeah. So, I was really surprised to find that a lot of the movies based on books are actually from short stories and documentaries, so not the novel that we naturally assume.
So I'll answer that. I've got an answer for that.
Great.
I think it makes perfect sense, because one of the big dilemmas always with making a movie out of a book is that books have many more layers and a lot more content than you can show visually in an hour and a half or 2 hours. And so things always have to be cut out. And everybody who's loved a book, is chances are one or another of these movies, they're going to cut the scene or the character. Often an entire character disappears. It was the one that was closest to your heart. So this is why people come away hating. There are other reasons as well, hating a movie version. And so with the short story, you solve a lot of that problem. You don't have to leave out very much, because you can actually, in fact, a really, really great movie, Ang Lee's version of Brokeback Mountain, was, I can't remember who, because I remember at the time we did a thing on at the library, supposed to be the most faithful version ever of a written work brought to the screen. And the reason was, it was a very short novella. Well, the reason was also it had a great director and so on, but it was based on a very short novella.
Yes, of course, it just... That so makes sense, you know. And then the story retains its plot and settings and, you know, essence, really, because the film director has been able to stay true to the story, I guess, because of that shortness. Right. Thank you for that explanation, Karen.
Oh, always happy to oblige. I'll put my bill in later.
Yeah. But, are you going to see any of the movies at that?
Well, I do. I have two picks. So the first one is Hunger, which is an old movie that, you know, the film festival in a very admirable way mixes old classics from the cinema and new releases. And it's Hunger, which is a movie from 1966, which might sound kind of old, but might not sound as old when you realize that the book is from 1890. So this is a book by the Norwegian writer Knut Hamsun called Hunger, which we read in our book club. I'd always wanted to read it. It's really considered a groundbreaking work in the history of literature. And it's an existential novel, perhaps the first existential novel. So it's a story, it's kind of like The Stranger, only instead of being in a hot hot Arab country, a hot Middle Eastern country, it's taking place in the cold Norway. So we have, every time the writer, he's a failed writer, is the hero of the book. Every time he says that he's hot with shame, you really get the, because he's actually shivering the cold, doesn't have enough to eat, this is the hunger. And his existential crisis is, you know, he's at what they call the shadow line. Well, Joseph Conrad invented the term the shadow line, which is that moment when you're passing into adulthood and you realize what you're going to leave behind and what you have to change. And what's facing him is the fact that you have to work and, you know, you have to exchange time for money. This is the way of the world. And so what does that do to your ideals? So it's a fantastic book. And I have Chris Greenhuff, who was in our book club lent me his copy, colleague at the library. So, Chris, if you're listening, I've still got your book.
4 years later. I'm holding on to it for you
when you come back to the book club. And the other one is Breath, Tim Winton's novel about two surfing buddies, coming-of-age novel about these two boys that are surfer buddies. And it was a book I would, again, talking of book clubs, I would never have read this book on my own, although I grew up in a surfing town, actually commemorated in a Beach Boys song, La Jolla, California. But so maybe for that reason, I didn't think I needed to read a coming-of-age novel. But it's actually about surfers. But it's actually about, as like all great works, it's not the surfers, it's just what they are and what Tim Winton knows and what he was, but it's actually about coming of age, adrenaline, coming of age, the fear, what's it going to be like, the fear of being normal, the fear of being too not normal. And it's been made into a movie that looks to be really, really good. And I think Tim Winton plays a part. What is Tim Winton's involved somehow?
Well, reading the program, Karen, I've read that he actually was involved in the screenplay.
In the screenplay, yeah. But he also appears, it's a voiceover. I think he does, yeah, he does a voiceover as the adult Pikelet. Isn't the kid named Pikelet? Am I getting that wrong?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
It's such a cute name, Pikelet. So I was reading that the director of the movie had this quote that came out. I'm not sure if it's in the festival booklet or if I saw it somewhere else, that he said what he really appreciated from Tim Winton in working on this when he set off to actually start making the movie, that Tim Winton said, he said he felt that he really needed to have the liberty to make a terrible movie if that was what was going to come out of it. He said that Tim Winton said, go ahead, mate, you do it. Like, you do the movie. Whether it's going to be terrible or not, the important thing is it's your movie, which is, of course, the battle that always comes forth when somebody has...
Actually, a very wise move by that, by the director, to say that, to sort of, you know, have the liberty to be sort of gifted the liberty by the authorization by the author to do what he wants. Because he must be, so obviously Tim must have liked the movie to participate in it with his voiceover and contributing to the screenplay. But there's got to be movies authors hate it.
Oh, it was probably, I think, a great majority.
What have you done to my work?
Yeah. So as far as I can tell, of the books that I've read and loved that were made into movies, almost every time the author was either already dead, but if he was alive, he didn't like it. So I was just thinking of Under the Volcano, but I won't go into that another time. So J.D. Salinger, this is my perfect example, because, you know, I've been reading, I was telling the other day, other transmission, that I've been reading My Salinger Life, this memoir of the assistant to the agent of J.D. Salinger. Mm-hmm. And in the book, she talks about how J.D. Salinger had refused to let any movies be made of any of his books. Because of one bad experience right at the start, where a movie was made out of one of the short stories in Nine Stories, which is Uncle Wiggily.
It's the cold
in Connecticut. That's a really gruesome story about the suburban dream and, an expose of the falseness of the false illusions of the suburban dream. And it was turned into a sentimental love story starring Susan Hayward. And Salinger was so shocked and angered that he refused to ever again sign away the rights to any of his works, which... I would like to raise a toast to J.D. Salinger that, because I feel that at least he saved us from James Franco buying the rights to Catcher in the Rye and casting himself as Holden Caulfield, which probably would have been my worst nightmare. I thought to myself, who would I have liked to see? I'd be really interested to hear. People are out there listening. Give us your feedback. Who would you like to see as Holden Caulfield? And I'm thinking my closest would be Jason Schwartzman around the time of when he did Rushmore. I think he could be pretty good, but I've got a few others in mind. Mm-hmm. So the choice of actors, that's actually another reason why a lot of authors have hated the movie versions of their books. So in particular, the example that comes to mind there is another funny story of Hemingway when A Farewell to Arms was made into a movie by David O. Selznick, was the producer, and David O. Selznick cast his wife, who was in her 40s, as the beautiful love interest, the nurse. So Farewell to Arms is set in the World War I in the Italian front, and it's semi-autobiographical because Hemingway was there, and he was in the hospital, and although not a soldier, he was there as a member of the press corps. But anyway, he did get wounded, and he was in the hospital, and he fell in love with his nurse, and the love story between the soldier and the nurse. And here's 40-year-old, not very good actress Jennifer Jones playing the nurse. So David O. Selznick apparently wired Hemingway when he made the movie that in those days, for whatever copyright reason, the producers didn't actually have to pay money to Hemingway, but O. Selznick didn't have to. But he wired Hemingway that he was going to send him $25,000, and Hemingway sent back a very rude telegram about what David O. Selznick could do with his $25,000, whatever it was, related to his having put this 40-year-old mannequin into the into the role of the beautiful love interest. Yeah, so that's another example. And then another...
He didn't appreciate his work being depicted and not the way he imagined it.
Well, the way he imagined it, but he lived it. Because it was actually, as I said, it was semi-autobiographical.
Yeah. So, and that reminds me of even the public... The change of the image of the character from the book, and then you translate into the movie. I was thinking of the criticism from the public about Tom Cruise being Jack Reacher, and the lead from the child books. Tom is not who they pictured Jack being.
So. Yeah. Well, James Bond movies, you know, this on and on and on about who should or shouldn't be able to play James Bond, considering that how long ago those books came out and how excited. I'm not even sure if people are referring back to the original Bond books or if they're referring to their ideas of, you know, movies, the James Bond movies they've seen recently. And, well, a lot of people didn't... in discussion about the Willy Wonka, you know, Gene Wilder being picked to play Willy Wonka. I actually am a big Gene Wilder fan, but I know that Roald Dahl, in that case, with that movie, what he didn't like was that Willy Wonka was made the star of the movie, because for Roald Dahl, the star was the boy, it was Charlie.
Mm.
And he didn't like the change of emphasis, which is another thing that Stephen King, for instance, didn't like when they filmed The Shining. The emphasis was all on Jack, with it being Jack Nicholson. It's kind of hard to, you know, see that it wouldn't be. But a crazed Jack Nicholson could steal the scene from anybody. But actually, Stephen King wanted the emphasis to be on the house. The house was the hotel, the big hotel in the mountains. That was supposed to be the crazy star of the movie.
Right. Anything? What about change of plot and ending? That's very common, isn't it?
A classic. So the making of the happy ending, which is probably the biggest criticism that gets laid to movie versions of books, because there is a feeling among... I've read a lot about this because I've been really curious of why do they do this? And it's defended by people in the movie industry by saying that... I'll put it out there. They have the right to their defense. That movie audiences don't want to be hit with a terribly sad, hopeless ending. When they have to get up and walk out of the theater, it's different than when you finish the book and you're sitting on your couch at home and you close the book and put it down. There's something about being in communion in a movie theater with people, and if they hit you with a thud with this bad ending, they think that then the movie will get a bad reputation, no one will go and see it, and it'll, you know, won't be a good movie experience.
Mm.
So
it's also that commercial factor of a little bit more than the book, I think. Maybe.
Yeah, well, exactly, the commercial factor. So people have to go home and tell their friends it was a great movie, you should go and see it. And they're not going to tell what Hollywood thinks is people are not going to say that to their friends if they've been hit with a thud with a bad ending at the end. They've had a, you know, something thrown at them. I was going to say a pillow, but a pillow fight actually sounds comedic. But something that hits you with a thud falls on your head. So one of the worst ones I ever saw was I had a cult novel. It's still one of my cult books, but particularly when I was growing up, and it was Breakfast at Tiffany's, as it was, I'm sure, a lot of people's. And Breakfast at Tiffany's is a very bittersweet book. So you read Breakfast at Tiffany's?
No, but we all know the movie.
You know the movie, okay. Audrey Hepburn, right. So in the book, the ending is very bittersweet. So the young man... who's the George Peppard part, what's his name in the book? I can't remember now. That George Peppard does so horribly in the movie. So he is, realizes he's never actually going to make, she is not for him. She's the wild bird that, you know, the cat that runs away, the wild bird that can't be kept in a cage. But in the movie, they end up finding her cat, and they leap after the cat's run away, and they're in the rain, and they get the cat, and they get into a taxi together and drive off, and what they're leaving you with, the definite feeling they're leaving you with, is that this is, you know, it's happening. It's for them. You know, they're in the taxi. They're going off together. Happy ending. And Truman Capote did really hate
that. We get this
impression
of they may not spell it out, but we get the impression, don't we?
Yeah. And even more than the happy ending, what Truman Capote really hated about Breakfast Tiffany's was actually the casting of Audrey Hepburn.
Oh.
You knew that. No, you didn't.
No.
Oh, yeah.
But I can't imagine the movie without Audrey. Now.
Yeah, so he, and I think rightly so, again, the story was semi-autobiographical for him about his young days in New York. And it was interesting because early on, I remember reading that a comment by some critic who was saying that he thought it was that she was actually a thinly disguised version of the boy upstairs that Truman would have been in love with. But actually, no, he says he was based on an actress that he knew and a number of actresses and sort of party girls around town. But they're all got that totally not the chic, thin Audrey Hepburn style. Their style is, they're more vulnerable, not quite so bony. More vulnerable, more tender. It's like a Marilyn Monroe. He said he would have been happy for Marilyn Monroe to play the part. But it was absolutely not an Audrey Hepburn part.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so I guess he, you know, dripping in diamonds, Marilyn... dripping in diamonds from Tiffany's or something like that. But it's interesting because in the New Zealand Film Festival is a movie, Cold Blooded, The Clutter Family Murders. And so when you're talking about Truman Capote, he also has another sort of infamous book. It was one of the first true crime books, I believe. What was the book called, Cameron?
The book was called In Cold Blood.
In Cold Blood, that's it.
Cold Blood and Murder is the name of the documentary.
Yeah, right. So in the film festival is this documentary on this murder of a Kansas family, the Clutter family, by two ex-prisoners, I think they're on parole, who had heard the father of the family had kept a lot of money or something in his safe, and so they decided that they wanted that money. And so it's a true story. And so apparently Capote was reading about the murder in a newspaper and decided to go and investigate it with his friend. Now, get this, his neighborhood friend, Harper Lee.
His childhood friend, yeah.
Yeah, yes. His childhood neighbor, Harper Lee. And I sort of thought, wow, sort of I was quite stunned by that. I thought New Zealand was the only place with 2 degrees of separation, you know. It's interesting.
Well, he's actually, he said, and a lot of people agree, I haven't heard it really, it's been very controversial, that he was the inspiration for Dill, for the character in To Kill a Mockingbird, the little boy that plays with Scout and Jem.
Oh, in To Kill a Mockingbird. Yeah. Which makes sense. Yeah. If they were childhood friends, right?
Oh. Yeah, In Cold Blood has been made into a movie as well, and it's a really, really good movie and really well cast. And
Was there a TV version?
I don't know.
Why do I think Sam Neill, our own Sam Neill, was in the TV version of...
who did he play? Truman Capote? No, I can't believe it. My voice just went up an
octave.
The policeman. I'm sorry, I was thinking of the documentary where Truman is in it. Because also in Capote, there's the movie Capote where... my favorite actor, Philip... help me. He plays Truman Capote. Oh, come on. With the three names. My favorite actor, Philip.
It'll come. So this is a movie about Capote's life, is it?
Yes. It's called Capote. Absolutely recommend it.
What an interesting character he is. I mean, he was openly gay, which was unusual for the time, I guess. And a friend of Andy Warhol's in New York.
I'm not sure that being closeted was a choice open to Truman, just from what he was, and it was really not a destiny that I think he could have picked. But I was just thinking back on the movies with changed endings before we ran off. I just wanted to tell one more really funny one, which was Mutiny on the Bounty. So this is based on a book. There was a book about the mutiny. I mean, it's obviously based on a true story, but there was also a historical fiction book about the Mutiny on the Bounty. But not even historical fiction, a historical telling of it in a narrative way by the Charles, what was his name? Nordenhall? Charles Nordenhall? Anyway, so when Marlon Brando was picked to play Fletcher Christian in the Mutiny on the Bounty movies, this was in the 60s sometime. I didn't know about this because my father was in Tahiti on an oceanographic expedition when they were filming Mutiny on the Bounty, and they were offered the chance to play the extras, play sailor extras in the film set. But they couldn't have beards because you couldn't have beards in the British Navy at the time. And a lot of the men on the oceanographic expedition had grown beards, and they didn't want to have to shave them off. So my father did not appear in Mutiny on the Bounty, but Marlon Brando did. And what Marlon Brando did was he wanted a big emoting acting scene for himself. And so he insisted that the film script be changed so that Fletcher Christian dies heroically in the end. He doesn't live on Pitcairn Island, but he, rushing back into the burning ship to retrieve his sextant, he dies in the arms of, I can't remember if his Tahitian lover or one of the other men, probably one of the other men, those being all a bit of bromances, those British
Navy.
So
they reversed the story. Normally the movie has a happy ending.
that's right.
The main characters don't die, they live on, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But that's Marlon for you.
Yeah, so another movie that we were talking about with the, when you and I earlier, we were talking about movies with changed titles. So I think this is pretty widespread out there now that a lot of people know that Blade Runner was based on a Philip K. Dick story that was actually called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And the reason
It
is a bit of a mouthful. But the reason why I say I think it's become common knowledge is that I was looking up yesterday knowing we were going to come in today and talk about movies. I looked up our copy of the library. They're all out and there's reserves on it, people waiting for it. So I'm thinking,
there you go. You
totally
librarian
possible,
you.
People. But so we've got this great book in the library, which there was a copy of at Central, but I've taken out. So, but there's a few other copies. And it's of that series, The Last Interview. Do you know about this wonderful series of books where they're all last interviews with various famous authors? And this was the last interview with Philip K. Dick. And he tells about when Ridley Scott filmed Blade Runner, that he actually had three different endings proposed. He was so uninterested in following the book, strictly following the book, that he actually, Ridley Scott, came up with three different endings, chatted with them, with Philip K. Dick, about the three possible endings, and Philip K. Dick liked all of them. So it's just a totally different way of owning your work of art, you know. Mm-hmm. He understood that it was changing hands and it was going to change medium, and therefore it would be a changed version, and he was keen on actually seeing how all three of them played out. It was giving him the go, yeah.
Oh, well, Philip wasn't very helpful at all then, was he? I'm sorry, I like all three. Yeah, but I can only choose one.
No, but Ridley wasn't showing them to him for his approval, I don't think. He was the maker. Yeah.
Well, it all started with the name change. But, maybe that ended with the name change. We're not sure.
I was going to ask you before we run out of time, so I think it's a really good chance to get our favorites in here because we are moving on, and I wanted to ask you, what's your favorite movie based on a book?
Right. Well, my favorite is a New Zealand novel, Mr. Pip. Lloyd Jones was the author. I think it was shortlisted for a Man Booker Prize. I can't remember the year.
It was definitely shortlisted. Yeah, I actually thought, no, I think it came within a hair of winning. Yeah, no, I remember.
Yeah, and it won a host of other awards. I loved the book. Loved the book. So, actually, I've never seen the movie.
Oh, you haven't seen the movie?
No, I can't bring myself to see the movie now because I loved the book. An interesting a little side story is that I was invited to, I had a ticket to see a pre-screening, you know, when, because
it's preview.
A New Zealand made movie. So they test the movie before its final cut.
Audience.
So I was
is that kind where you get to press little buttons to say if you like it or don't like it?
I don't know. I didn't go.
Okay.
I know you signed some sort of document agreeing not to share what you've seen with people. Because so I thought, no, I'm not going to see it. I can't. You know, my memory of the book was so enjoyable and strong and vivid and everything. I thought, no, I'm not going to have it ruined by seeing the movie. So I never went. But afterwards, so I gave my ticket to a friend, and afterwards I said, so what? You know, shall I go to the movie? Does it stay true to the book? And she said, I can't tell you, I signed a document. So that was the end of my curiosity to see the movie. Yeah. I loved the book. Yeah. It's a fantastic book.
I do know that the actress from Mr. Pip, who plays the girl, came to Auckland for the, the launch, what's it called when the film opens? For the opening. And she came and visited the library. They came and interviewed her, and they asked her what her favorite book was. And I remember we had to find a copy. Some TV show came and interviewed her, and we had to find a copy of Fairy Tales, because those were her favorite books. Her favorite book was not Great Expectations, but Fairy Tales. So we had to hide them in the shelf nearby so that the television presenter could pull it out and go, you mean like this? But she was beautiful, girl. Oh, lovely. Yes. Really, absolutely fantastic.
And she was a lucky girl. She got to act next to Mr. Hugh Laurie.
Yeah. So my favorite, speaking of Great Expectations, which was not the favorite of the girl who played the character in Mr. Pip movie.
But very much
my favorite movie based on a book. Excuse me?
I was just saying, very much a part of the movie and the book, Great Expectations.
Yes, yes, exactly. So coincidentally, and a happy coincidence, perhaps my favorite, hard to say, there's so many, Shawshank Redemption is another one of my favorites, but I'm going to put this one out because it fits in so well with your story, which is that the Great Expectations, not the more recent costume drama in color one, which I don't know much about and didn't see, but there was a 1946 version of Great Expectations, which is directed by David Lean, which is just one of the old black and white movies, terrifying, beautifully acted. So John Mills plays Pip and Gene Simmons plays Estella. And the convict is the scariest scene ever. Leaps out at Pip as he's walking through the graveyard at night in the fog in this black and white movie, incredibly evocative, is Finlay Curry, the great English actor Finlay Curry. And I couldn't believe it. I actually saw, I can't remember, I think it might have been on our library catalog record where people can write their reviews. Somebody's going, oh, I can't believe this movie. John Mills was 40 and he's playing 20-year-old Pip. And it was just, I just had this realization. It was like the story of Jennifer Jones playing the nurse. Jennifer Jones could not play the 20-year-old nurse because she, not because she was 40, but because she was a bad actress. Because John Mills playing 25-year-old Pip or whatever he is fantastic. He's just, it is such a great movie. And Alec Guinness is in it, too, in the role of Herbert Pocket. So
did he play Pip all the way through, from boy to...
No, there's a boy actor, and then John Mills is the older actor. Yeah, so he doesn't play the five, he just plays the nine-year-old Pip. Gene Simmons plays the young Estella, and then there's an older Estella, which is not an actress that I'm really aware of. But I think anyone who likes Charles Dickens should go and hunt down that movie. We do have it at the library. So,
how are we going for time, Karen?
We've got about 2 minutes, and you were going to...
Yeah, because I didn't realize, I read somewhere that Don Quixote is said to be unfilmable, which makes me, I'm trying to get through it at the moment.
That's right, you're reading it, we heard about that, it's your current read. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it, it's entertaining, though it is a bit of a struggle, the language and translation maybe is lost, you know, from Spanish to English, but really enjoying it. But so another book that I've got at home, 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel
Marquez.
Yes. I'm really happy to say that discover that apparently the rights haven't been sold for that book either. So I've got there's no pressure on me to get through them
in time to see them at the film festival.
That's right.
Okay, well, that's perfect timing for me to contribute one more thing, which is such a victory for me. Philip Seymour Hoffman. The actor that I couldn't remember his name.
Oh, well done.
So
I knew it would come to you.
Yeah. So in with that, what we say we're wishing everyone good viewing, happy viewing.
Enjoy the film festival, everyone. And please send us your feedback on the show or perhaps movies that you've
the movies
seen
we it. Missed. Yeah. We can always do a catch-up.
Yeah, it's true.
And tune in next week.
Yeah, Ka Kitiano.
Ka Kitiano. We'll be right back. program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond. Every day.